Sorry, we're not hearing anything on Zoom.
I said, Amen to the Buddha, Amen to the Dharma, Amen to the Sangha.
I guess that. Thank you.
So we are in the last week of term. And so next Sunday we'll do a term closing ceremony. And it's a chance to reflect on how the last 3 months have gone, whether we met our practice aspirations or not. I think this is going to be I hope this is a fairly practical talk. It's going to touch on some basics that most of us have heard of, mindfulness and non-self, but it'll also zoom in on the part of mindfulness that meets the edginess that we find with others. And it may be that you got here this morning and you're just in from your cave on the mountain and haven't had to deal with this for many years. In which case, I hope you have a nice zazen while I ramble on. But if you haven't been living in a cave up on a mountain, then I imagine this will be useful. So just a snapshot of like the problem we're meeting here. A mind that has not coalesced around wholesome states, right? Wholesome intent tends to lurch towards the perceived suffering and future suffering. Mindfulness helps us hold the mind in a shape that can be aware of more. And holding it in that shape requires frequent care. When our mind is coalesced around caring, metta, appreciation, other positive aspects of mind, we have access to a lot more information and thus many more choices. It's a richer way to live. In interpersonal relationships, interactions, if we're not settled in a state of mindfulness, that lurch can be initiated by a flatness in the tone of voice, a quality of eye contact, a turning away from all kinds of things, right? Certain words or phrases. And, we've collectively evolved in such a way that noticing social threat is very important. There are many cues that we might use to affirm or deny our belongingness. And sometimes that's accurate, and often it's not. And always the assumption of abiding self is extra. And that's kind of Buddhism's unique addition to this conversation. So if we notice that type of threat, that I might not belong in some way that matters, and I'm in this condition of lurchiness, of not being mindful, there's a strong impulse to defend my case, right? To insist on some tactic, to judge or blame. There's a feeling of tightness, right? And we identify with that tightness. And we imagine that the source or cause of that tightness is probably someone else or something else outside of us. If we have a well-established habit of invoking mindfulness, we might notice that we're feeling constriction and intentionally broaden our awareness. We don't want to lurch through our life, we want to dance. We want more possibility, we want more grace. Broadening awareness might give us a chance to check our perceptions by asking questions, making requests, anchoring in a wholesome experience. When we do these things, we're going to feel incrementally more expansive. If we're feeling more expansive, insight into the situation is much more likely. it doesn't mean that the whole situation is pleasant, right? Just that in the midst of this difficult situation, like kids are having a meltdown, or I have conflict with an overbearing coworker, or a neighbor makes a snide comment, right? Partner has a difficult day. In the midst of that difficult situation, we can also access some expansive part of our experience, right? There's a lot going on. We can choose where we attend. So that's the skeleton of where we're going, and I want to add some detail. But first, I want to read a poem. And this is from the Pali Canon. Life, personhood, pleasure, and pain. This is all that's bound together in a single mental event, a moment that quickly takes place. Even the spirits who endure for 84,000 eons, even those do not live the same for any two moments of mind. The states which are vanishing now and those which will vanish someday have characteristics no different than those which have vanished before. There's no hoarding what has gone, no piling up for the future. Those who have been born are standing like a seed upon the needle. The vanishing of all these states that have become is not welcome, though dissolving phenomena stand uncombined from primordial time. From the unseen, states come and go, glimpsed only as they're passing by. Like lightning flashing in the sky, they arise and then pass away. So this is it's speaking to all those themes, right? Mindfulness, non-self, how precise a moment is. And that's where I want to go to kind of flesh out this skeleton. So Abhidhamma is the third basket of Dharma in the Pali Canon. There's the sutras, which are like the stories. There's the Vinaya, which are like the rules-ish. And then there's the Abhidharma. All three are voluminous, and the Pali Canon was just like the launching pad for another 2,000 years of commentary and evolution. And Abhidharma is the part which is sort of this project of distilling and synthesizing Buddhist teachings about the phenomenology of our experience, taking it from the narrative expository tone of the sutras and creating a systematic integrated system. It's like moving the Dharma from a Word document into an Excel spreadsheet. When we learn to see the Dharma in a spreadsheet, different things may pop out. And one of the things that is fascinating is what coexists with what. So people remember from foundational teachings that there are five skandhas. These are the heaps, the aggregates. We just reviewed them this morning when we chanted the Heart Sutra, form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. That fourth skandha, Sankara in Sanskrit, or formation, is a doozy. It takes up a lot of space on that spreadsheet. There's lots of different versions of Abhidharma or Abhidhamma, but in whatever version you're playing with, Sankaras is the big one. It's where it's describing our cognitive and emotional experience. So And one thing that's interesting there is that the for the skandhas for sensation, perception, and consciousness, they're all based on the verb to know. Formation is based on the verb to do, right? So there's this active, intentional making-doing quality to all of this. And Part of what's interesting about Abhidharma is it's this tool, right? It's So feel free to argue with anything I say here, like test it out, like prove it for yourself. It's an experiential method for getting more familiar with our mind. It gives us a vocabulary with which to do that. So coexistence is fascinating. There are 18 other factors that always coexist with mindfulness. And there's also a few that sometimes appear. And that set of factors that appear with mindfulness, either all the time or some of the time, are called the beautiful factors. Factor is chittasika, if you are reading about this. A couple of notes. One is that you'll never find wholesome and unwholesome factors present in the same state of mind. So that poem where it's talking about like, you know, even if you live 84,000 eons, like one moment is different from the next. At those moments, those states of mind are fairly brief, right? Experientially, we have somewhere between several and many in a second. There are degrees of mindfulness. Colloquially, like we talk about mindfulness as any moment of being aware of our experience with a quality of kind of steady observation rather than being caught by. There's a little bit of distance, like the vantage point includes our sense of self in that whole picture. And I think that's a useful way to recognize it. And just to acknowledge that, like, that probably flickers a bit, right? The duration of mindfulness might be quite short, just a few mind moments at a time. And that can get much more stable with practice. And more rigorous definitions usually require a degree of not wobbling for it to be called mindfulness. So we might have a moment of mindfulness, and then the next moment might be something entirely different, something not wholesome. And that's what life is like. It's kind of discontinuous. But I found that to be true. I've never found wholesome and unwholesome chittasika at the same time. So if mindfulness is present, so is equanimity. So is non-harming. So is non-greed. Broadly, it's benevolent. It's not attached. There's also respect for self and respect for others. That's Hiri and Atapam. Those are known as the guardians of the world because they coexist with all the other beautiful states of mind. And these are the means by which we discern what is appropriate. Self-respect is kind of like conscience. It helps us notice whether our intentions, our actions are in accord with our sense of integrity. So mindfulness is inherently moral. That's an active part of it. Respect for others is kind of an interpersonal version of that, in which we attune to the impact in others on our speech, of our expression, of our action. There's also faith, and then six more: tranquility, buoyancy, malleability, wieldiness, proficiency, and integrity. And those last six, they count as 12 because they're paired, so there you can be tranquil in both body and mind. You get into some fine details there, but that gives you a sense of what's included in a moment of mindfulness. All of that is present. And part of what I'll just pull out about that conversation of like wieldiness of body, wieldiness of mind, is that this is expressed, right? Like we see it in others. It's valuable to practice around others because we see this in expression and we attune to that. So earlier we were talking about the five skandhas, the five aggregates: form, sensation, perception, formation, and consciousness. These are what make up the sense of self. So if those five things are present in a moment, we perceive that there's a sense of self there. It's reflexive. So the mind organizes experience around a particular structure, and just because it's faster and easier to make sense of all that experience. That structure is I, me, mine, right? That's a useful way to get through the world in some respects. It's not Abhidharma level accurate, right? It's very provisional. And because it's provisional, it feels fragile in a kind of fundamental way. So say the neighbor makes a comment about our lawn, and when are you going to mow that? And there's just a little something in the voice there, right? And our mammalian system for noting social discord activates, and we have in ourself physical cues of threat, right? There's some fleshing here. There's some constriction here. There's probably a little sense of urgency, like it's happening a little fast for us. There's probably some like narrowing of focus, of zooming in on some aspect of the situation. Highly likely, it's an uncomfortable part of the situation. From an Abhidharma perspective, at the sensation level, sensation is like pleasant, unpleasant, undetermined, or neutral, right? So it's just this little like sorter, and like an experience comes in and it meets this little like router, and there's three options. And it's not pre-conscious, but it's pre-volitional. It's very quick. It's very light. And so in that moment, we hit an unpleasant. There was something about that which we didn't like. And it was high enough volume that it activated, you know, we got reactive and zoomed in on that unpleasant part of it. We devoted more attention to it. Much of our attention is conditioned, right? Much of our cognition is conditioned. And until we've spent an awful lot of time in mindfulness, conditioning is going to lead us to try to protect that sense of self, right? It's just like the table is weighted, right? It's leaning that direction. We first protect, I, me, mine, by making some sort of meaning, right? That's a very immediate response. Some bit of explanation that pulls more from our personal history than the immediate situation is often somewhat tragic in impact, meaning that it cements unwholesome states of mind. So that bit of story might be something like, I don't belong, or I don't do it well enough, or he hates me, or whatever. It's quite unpleasant, and it tends to aggravate the situation. And if that happens, and we defend, we withdraw, we blame, the sympathetic nervous system is rolling, and we're not in touch with our experience in a subtle way. So there's a certain amount of like momentum can gather quickly there. So that's why the with mindfulness, part of mindfulness is sati in Sanskrit, which is, you know, comes out of the verb to remember. So it's this, what it's asking for is this frequency of remembering, right? So when we get that, when it goes through the router, like right then, that's when we want to like remember. That's the ideal time. We can remember once we're flushed and growling. It's just that there's more work at that point, right? We have to undo more, and the physical manifestation lasts longer than the cognitive manifestation, right? So there's the half-life is longer of an emotion. So if we move towards mindfulness, we notice that unpleasant sensation, right? Oh, it went that way. We notice the urge to explain it, and maybe we soften. Maybe we slow down. Maybe we kind of broaden a little bit instead. We notice what's starting to happen and we choose something else. The neighbor's tone may have stung, right? It may actually be unpleasant, but it doesn't actually sting I, me, mine, right? That's the construct. And because it's a construct, I don't have to defend that. I don't have to, right? I have more options. I'm not compelled. When I can see it as construct. So it's helpful. Like, that's all true. And one place people miss is by like kind of getting a little intellectual there of like don't mess that up. So it's helpful to also have some place positive to aim, right? It's not just a matter of don't get caught in believing a self, which is like, it's pretty hard. It's hard to deconstruct the self in the midst of activity, and it's not always necessary. And so that's why I brought up the, you know, this concept of coexistent states, all of the things, the, you know, malleability, flexibility, integrity that go along with mindfulness, right? There's other things that we can tilt towards. Respect for self, respect for other. If it's present, we can accentuate it. We can amplify it. If it's not pleasant, we can look for it. We can invite it. Things like that. And broadly, like that, we want to welcome our experience. Right? Welcoming is malleability of mind, right? It's faith. It's a bunch of those. We want to invite whatever our experience is into awareness. There's this gracious, spacious quality to mind. When we resist, we constrict, right? We inhibit the flow of experience and awareness. There's less life, less available. And so the sense of both discomfort and perceived threat goes up. So if we notice resistance, like, which is beyond just the like unpleasant sensation, but then there's the like hardening around that unpleasant sensation, welcome your actual experience. Like, hey, you get an unpleasant sensation to experience. Like, you're big enough, do it. Like, feel that, it's great. It's interesting, just as it is. And if we do that, if we hold that welcome, beautiful factors arise, right? That's sowing those seeds. A coarser version of this is substitution, which is kind of like muscling it instead of finessing it, right? Where we just sort of forcibly move the attention somewhere else. To something, moving it to something wholesome and holding it there, which is good, like that's valid. Sometimes that's important. It's just that it takes a lot of effort. And if you're not up for that amount of effort, it doesn't happen. So it'll happen naturally if we can welcome our experience exactly as it is. So again, faith is part of mindfulness. There's some likely misunderstandings here that show up in the Sanzen room with some frequency. One of the things practitioners tell themselves is, I shouldn't feel this. Buddhism is not advising us to deny our experience or to deny the impact of our experience on us. We want reality deeply. It's just saying, like, let's de-emphasize that extra step of identity. So we can say, ouch, if we hear a curt tone from our neighbor. We can trust that information. We want to be more careful with the, he doesn't respect me, or he thinks I'm doing it wrong, right? Those are only there because of this sense of self. It's also not a practice failure for I, me, and mine to appear. Right? It's a reflex. We just want to develop the capacity to see that as, to see I, me, mine as process, as tentative, as provisional. I'm much more interested in the frequency of noticing and the speed of recovery than whether or not I, me, mine appears. That's where practice really shows up. We're going to get caught, right? Like, that's okay. We're going to take things personally at times. And as insight accrues, we can put more and more weight into understanding that, into an understanding of self that is diffuse, that is interdependent and always in flux. It's deeply true that we only exist in relation to this broader world. And so that line between self and other is a figment. And if that's true, then if I, me, and mine shows up, like, it's okay. It's just figment. And if it's okay, we feel safer about noticing our experience. And that creates a wholesome cycle instead of a tragic one. Another myth that happens is a kind of attachment to this idea of like a lack of an independently existing self, and the assumption that that means that I don't count, right? That selflessness means like I don't have needs. And even if we don't hang everything on a structure of self, there are still needs, there are still values, there are still responsibilities. We matter. We just matter in a bigger way than we typically assume. If we can create wholesome cycles like this with some regularity, evoking mindfulness and the 18 coexistent states, we stop the grosser versions of attribution of identity, right? The default there. We spend less time taking things personally, and our relationships become more harmonious. When we're consistently not threatened by the appearance of unpleasant sensations, we have so many more options. We can clarify someone's intent instead of litigating our rightness. We can make more specific requests and offer more effective apologies because we have access to more vulnerability. We can invite or receive feedback without spiraling into shame. It's really nice. Also, the grosser attribution of identity is a massive time suck. Like, we can sink so much energy into replaying past scenarios or preparing for future conversations or defending our perspective, or, you know, it's all contriving reality for the self. So if we're abstaining from a certain percentage of that, like, those are free hours. And we can spend that in ways that build resource or capacity. More capacity means we're more likely to interrupt that sequence early, right? There's an unpleasant sensation, vedana. Shoop. Interpretation, reaction that solidifies a sense of self. We can interrupt it sooner the more mindful we are. It's still hard, right? Like, studying the self is inherently uncomfortable. The sense of self is not pleasant. It's somehow limited by everything it relates to, right? Like that's dukkha. That's a wheel that's out of tune. So if we're mindful, like, we're going to have lots of moments of noticing that out of tuneness, right? That's negative sensation. So like, that's not a failure. That's a win. That's life, right? That's we just want to then follow that with openness, welcoming that. So I'm describing different cycles here, different ways the wheels turn, with or without conscious awareness. Without, you know, it's functionally adequate. We get through the week. And like our activity, our effort tends to reinforce instinctual conditioned interpretations and behaviors, right? It preserves an experience of self that's heavily conditioned by our personal history. With conscious awareness, with more mindfulness, it's more of a reformulating loop. Mindfulness gives us this reflective capacity that allows much more feedback, much more adjustment. We're much more involved in and active in intentionally participating in this process of self. And that's what that poem is about, the precariousness of this seed balanced on a needle. Right? Every moment, it's a new seed balanced. Which way does it go? Which way do we go?
If you're in the center, please raise your hand and I will bring the microphone to you. Please offer your name before you offer your question or comment and hold the microphone close to your mouth. If you are on Zoom, you can write your name or your question and Tony will unmute you or read the question out for you.
Thank you for the wonderful talk. It really spoke to me in something that I've been struggling with for quite some time. I don't want to tell a really long story here, but just to give a little bit of background, I've struggled a lot with a relationship with my stepmother and also a longtime friend. And things that come up in those relationships a lot are words like abuse, and they've been really challenging relationships, also beautiful, wonderful relationships, but also very challenging relationships. So as you're talking about this, you know, comment from a neighbor that stings, you know, it's really challenging when those sorts of things come from people that are very close to us, mm-hmm. people that know us, that say that they know who we are, right? Sometimes, literally, something my stepmom said, like, I know who you are better than you are. What comes to mind that spoke to me was that thing about having our own needs, right? Obviously, we have to consider what our own needs are in those scenarios, which has led me to terminate these relationships. Getting to my question, in these moments where they have said certain things, it feels like maybe they had like a sense of obligation to my time or actions or how I was engaging with other people. Mm. And they felt somehow harmed mm-hmm. by this and felt very strong emotions and were very clear letting me know what emotions that they had about my actions and, things like selfish and, you know, there's all sorts of criticisms and attacks that came out of that. One of the things that really sticks for me coming and chanting and reading and studying Buddhism is the part about obligation. Mm. And those words about like to not obey and obligation. And so one of the things that I continue to be very curious about is maybe how, like, is there some way I could have approached things differently, or where does that sense of obligation fit in?
Yeah,
especially when it comes to those relationships, if it is, you know, a parent,
sure,
or
sure,
a longtime friend, someone who's just really, you know, you do feel this really strong sense of obligation, and how does that, how does that work in this?
Great. Yeah. Thank you. That's clear. And I just want to also, like the closer the relationship, like the more leverage it has in terms of ability to affect us and like the quickness which we, our identity gets threatened. So yeah, that is, it's more challenging. I think part of the, like, I would lean on the respect for self and respect for others a little. If we're doing something out of a sense of obligation, like my guess is that when you are using that word, you probably, there's a sense of tightness somewhere. And there's something where like it's at cost in a way which you're not actually okay with. And so like, you know, like there's push and pull, like there's competing stuff, but like to me, like when I'm feeling that, it's a sign that I'm not ready to act or speak or whatever. Like I haven't hit clarity yet. I'm still in that, like, ooh, there's multiple selves present. I'm being pulled in different directions. And so like I make space. I try to give myself some time or give myself some attention so I can kind of move out of that. If someone's asking for something and I feel obliged and tight, like I may force myself to offer it and it's probably not going to go that well, right? It's not really what they want. And I'm more likely to feel resentment. So like it's, you know, that respect for self, like I want to be a compassionate person. I want to be like, I want to like express metta easily, frequently, like largely, right? And so like doing something which is conducive to a state of resentment is not that, right? That's not showing respect for myself. So that's kind of where I would go. Does that land?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Hey, it's Sonia. I'm glad you brought up metta. I think the Cultivating Compassion workshop is a really great follow-up to this talk if people are interested, because it gives us a chance to practice what can actually be cultivated in those more wholesome mm-hmm. states. So mm-hmm. I'm glad that came up. I also wanted to just draw attention to, it's so odd how when we most need mindfulness is, for me, when I'm like, it's the hardest to find. I'll admit we had term student yesterday and it was a wonderful day, but I was pretty drained this morning and I was sitting in Zazen and I was just kind of like crunchy, like just kind of, you know, like, and it, I'm a little drained, you know, yeah. And I really was like foggy and mindfulness really did not want to be present. Like, I don't want to feel crunchy and foggy, and it was much easier to just zone out. And that's when it's, you know, it's like, what is it about our conditioning that's like, or at least mine, that wants to stray so far from things feeling a little bit uncomfortable or out of balance?
That's not just you. To hear that, that's proof. And I like that, you know, like the that list of what shows up with mindfulness, like it's all basically versions of being like gracious, right? Of like, well, yeah, I can adapt to this. That may be an overstatement, but it tilts that direction pretty strongly. And it's just like that ability to like be at ease with something uncomfortable is so valuable. And it's so frequent conditioned experience. a lot of leverage there.
Thanks.
This is going. I'm going to take that a step further, I think. this is, I mean, mine. An experience that I've been having frequently in the last few months, and I thought about when you mentioned the term, and I've been thinking about this as the term is coming to a close, but it goes back even further, which is having times when I just don't sleep well. And having to be functional day after day with not enough sleep, and then being like that, like day after day. And I think the bit of respect that I show myself, like I've observed this at work regularly, is I know I'm not well resourced to have good responses to those kinds of things, and so what I need to do is like that's the mindfulness right there. It's just like holding that awareness that I am not well resourced, and so. Avoiding conflict, it's not like I'm pushing it away, but like maybe avoiding situations where it could come up, because I just know I won't be able to respond well. And it's a source of frustration that I feel like I spend a lot of time being just in a state of utter exhaustion and wishing I felt better resource to respond better.
Yeah. There's a, it's a whole other Dharma talk, like this kind of interplay between like the strength of dissociation of squashing our experience of like how, effective that can be, like in conventional terms. And as we really attune to ourselves, we're not as willing to cause that much harm, right? There's a lot of cost there, and so we have to reset a little bit, the period of time when I really really learned that was. When the Sangha moved here, and there were it was a 3-year period where I was so under resourced and my practice was miserable, and I chose it and it was worth it, and the decision to come out of that was really prioritizing it's time for self-respect. It's time to really put the contemplative practice first. Whatever will happen will happen, and really there's that faith part of just letting that roll.
Hi.
Hey, Annie Rose.
I guess friendship may be the sticky one. I've had some really good friendships, and then I get people who come up to me and say, we can't be friends, or I won't be your friend because you're religious. And it's, I don't know. I mean, does that mean they're putting themselves first before me? Because when I come here, it's like, I have to put myself first. And the only way for me to find that positive place is the Zen Center, it seems like. Because when I'm out there, I'm seeing a lot of pissed off people, angry people, miserable people. And it's like, why do they even bother? I mean, I don't know. I don't get it. You know, I'd rather be religious and be kind and respectful and all this stuff. And they're running around causing a mess.
I would rather you be religious and kind and respectful as well. What I would say there, Annie Rose, is if someone says, hey, you know what? I don't want to be your friend. The tendency, if we're believing in self, is to imagine that statement is about me. And really to notice what they're actually, you put on your little translation hat, what they're actually saying is I hurt. And they're telling you something about them. And just like, you know, you can feel compassion there, right? Like that's something that they're showing you, and they may or may not know that they're showing you it, but like, ooh, that's too bad for them.
Yeah, and it just turns me away from them is what it does, because then I don't want to be their friends.
Mm-hmm. This is Andy. I'll do a quick one. I want to double click on the spreadsheet. Open it up. It's interesting to me. I mean, that's super interesting because I look at spreadsheets all day for work anyhow. So it's, I'm like, oh, that's cool. But where I'm struggling is this sort of quantized discrete states of things, right? So like I feel emotion A, then emotion B and emotion C. And the word that popped into my head was when you said, talking about the lightning, was the concept of bittersweet. And it's both. I have this feeling of it can be both. It's not bitter then sweet or sweet then bitter. It's both at the same time. So I'm not asking you to defend the Abhidharma, but I'm wondering what is that? I'm sort of resisting the quantized separateness versus almost a non-dual bittersweet can be both simultaneously. Is there a conflict between these ideas?
Let's simplify it just a little bit. So bittersweet, like that phenomenon could appear in multiple states. Can you imagine it being a pleasant sensation as well as being an aversive sensation?
Yes.
Yeah, I've felt that. So what happens is there's the seed on the needle, right? So there's that kind of fragmentary, momentary, very precise, very immediate. And our phenomenological experience is that these kind of mush and aggregate together. And so we might have, 20,000 seeds on a needle in a row about a really good tantrum that we threw, right? That's how we might represent that on the spreadsheet, which is a long line of spikiness. And but within that, there's you might have a one spike of resentment and then one spike of irritation and one spike, all these different things within that. And there might even be within that, 4 minute window, of that experience of anger, you might have several moments of mindfulness, right? So and that's normal. That's what we would expect. So it's it's a matter of how close you get to it. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a matter of, it's almost like time, sort of this averaging effect of these things over time. Right.
And
it coalesces into a thing of called bittersweet.
And that's exactly how we get this sense of self.
Yeah.
Right? None of us can actually find self. Right. Yeah. There's just this sort of emergent, that's me, right? But we can't point to it.
Thanks.
It's just it's happening fast enough to create that illusion.
Hey, this is Charlie. I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about the muscling to the finessing. I find myself, if I can control the positive things that I'm doing, right, I can have the outcome I want, right? So I'm muscling, which is better than nothing, but I'd like to get into finessing. So how do I start to do that?
Great. Nice. The short answer is trust, really. Is exactly this. It's really it's so reliable. And if we open up to it, regardless of, its unpleasantness or not, but if what matters is not the content, but how we're relating to it, right? Like that's the part that counts. And so if we're substituting, we're focused more on the content, right? We're like, oh, that's a bad state. I want a good one. And so we go there. But just being, just having this quality of metta towards your experience, just like welcoming, oh, what is this? Malleability of mind, like that creates a positive state. And there's not that extra turbulence.
Thank you.
The last one.
Following up on what the last person said, the muscling or the finessing, how does that relate to letting go and trust?
Quite closely, I think. I think so. If we trust, if we can let go and really experience this right now, that's like what we're offering is mindfulness. If we don't trust, like if we need to fix it, if we see that this is a problem, like we're resisting our experience, right? So we might be able to salvage it via some like rawr, but it's more work, you know, and there's more there's just more ways for it to miss, and you know. Right, thank you.